Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Soupcast, coming to you from ArchaeoSoup Towers. By popular demand, we're taking selected videos from the ArchaeoSoup back catalogue and bringing them to you as convenient podcasts. As the name implies, with ArchaeoSoup, you get a bit of everything thrown into the pot. Archaeology, discussion, humour and debate. You can find out more at archaeosoup.com. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a hearty helping of Archaeo Soup.
Hello, and welcome back to the Watching Brief for the week of the 6th of September 2021. I am joined, as ever, by probably a slightly muggy Mr. Andy Brockman. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning. Yeah, here in South East London, it's muggy and damp, it's drizzling outside, it's not particularly exciting.
it's quite warm here. I think we're about to get a storm, hence I have a fan right next to my head, so if there's any residual noise at home, folks, apologies for that, but I cannot sit here otherwise. I'm afraid this morning it's very, well, I'd say it's muggy and hot.
And we apologise in advance if you disappear in a big blue flash as you're struck by lightning.
Precisely, yeah. Just regardless, though, whether I'm struck by lightning or not, our Watching Brief continues our ongoing mission to examine the archaeological news of the week and present it here for you for your delectation, delight and discussion below. Initially, though, before we dive into this Watching Brief, we have a quick update from Chester University, where there has been an ongoing review process underway as to staffing and therefore aspects of academic provision, and it seems to be tentatively good news. Andy,
it is good news. It's undoubtedly good news in the moment, because earlier on this week the university vice chancellor, who's called Professor Eunice Simmons, emailed staff to say that a dispute that had been running really for most of this year, which was the into potential compulsory redundancies across several departments, including archaeology. The university has now concluded its process and its dispute with the University College Union, and there are going to be no compulsory redundancies this year.
Okay.
So all the jobs in all the departments, apart from anyone who wishes to take voluntary severance, are safe.
Okay. That's good. But presumably, though, that's this year. Is there any implications to what might happen next year, perhaps?
That is the problem. I've seen an email that Professor Simmons sent, and in that email she talks about a number of issues that remain outstanding, and in particular that that there are a number of departments where student numbers, the university claims, don't merit the staffing levels that they currently have or going forward, and that there will be they want to enhance department and viability by looking at how to enhance student recruitment, and to she talks about repositioning subjects in to ensure their chance of viability in future years. So the axe is still hovering there, the sword of Damocles. It's still secure for the moment, but the thread maybe is getting a little bit thinner.
At least, though, no talk of vanity courses. But obviously, we'll come to that for our Muppet segment this month.
Viewer, that was a trailer to the Muppet of the Month. Boy, it is a good one. It is a good one.
Anyway, before we get there, we need to talk about a few stories that we bundled together this week that have a common theme of the live environment that's represented by museums, historic studies, the presentation of the past, and I suppose even the public discussion of the past, or even specifically, I suppose, a national story, and how it's inescapably difficult. It can be very difficult at times to be an archaeologist, a historian, a curator, an educator in this sort of environment, and particularly when you're trying to balance what we termed, when we were writing the agenda for this week's Watching Brief, what we termed the difference between consent and censorship, the difference between a sort of a process of understanding and in some cases recontextualizing the past versus genuinely trying to hide the past and deny that it ever happened. And this conversation, or these thoughts, were kicked off in particular by a news story that we were linking to from The Guardian this week, with the headline, Hong Kong Police Raid Tiananmen Massacre Museum. Hong Kong authorities have raided the city's Tiananmen Massacre Museum a day after arresting four members of civil society group that ran it. The raid is the latest act by the police in a sweeping crackdown on dissident civil society groups that do not toe the pro-Beijing line, and came on the same day 12 activists pleaded guilty over banned Tiananmen vigils that were held last year. The June the 4th Museum, which has for 2 years displayed information and historical items related to the massacre of student protesters in Beijing on the 4th of June 1989, is run by the Hong Kong Alliance in support of patriotic democratic movements in China, which has been accused of foreign collusion under a new, under a national security law that's been newly applied to them. So this is an instance where history, relatively recent history, because it's politically so sensitive, especially for the government in charge, the regime in charge, that is actually being hidden. There's actually a photo here of exhibition information panels and foam board displays being packed into the back of a truck to be taken to places unknown, perhaps even actually actively to be destroyed. And I suppose just to, in terms of this conversation, this balances rather interestingly with another story from this week. On the 8th of September, Reuters news agency reported that a statue of Confederate Commander Robert E. Lee was removed from its base in Richmond, Virginia's capital, early on Wednesday after a year-long legal battle over a monument that has been the focus of protests over racial injustice. As onlookers watched, crews secured the 21-foot, 6.4-meter bronze statue of the U.S. Civil War leader to a crane that hoisted it off its 40-foot, 12.2-meter granite pedestal and placed it on the ground. The statue has been taken into storage pending a review as to where it may be sort of, essentially, as they would say in this country, explained elsewhere, maybe put on some sort of public display with an exploration of its particular history in another place. And this is the difference, isn't it? We have, on the one hand, Hong Kong actively censoring a civil understanding of a crucial part of activist history versus a process that's undergone a year-long legal battle, and this is the result of it. And crucially, the statue, Robert E. Lee, is not going to be taken to somewhere where we don't know where it is. We know where it's going, and it's likely to be on display in some other capacity in the near future. Where do you think some of these balances and these sort of nuances come into play when it comes to the role of talking about the past and being honest about it as archaeologists and historians? I suppose part of the problem is the fact I can't imagine trying to tell an honest story about the past in a regime like China's.
That, I think, is the problem. I think for any of us who work in heritage, in archaeology, in creating narratives about the past and communicating narratives about the past, that we have to be aware of the political context within which we work, the political and social and cultural context within which we work. It's why, you know, archaeological stories, archaeological narratives, cultural narratives are being reworked all the time. It's what historians do. You know, we take the evidence, we recontextualize it sometimes, we discover new nuances, we discover new documents, new information. It's a constant debate with ourselves and then with the publics that we try and communicate with. But I think there's a huge difference, though, between and reconsidering the past is a perfectly normal, natural thing. It's what has happened as long as people have been discussing their pasts. I think what these two stories highlight, however, is what you've just explained, really, that there is a huge difference between a consensual legal process that's done in the open and involves debating a contested past, which people will disagree on and will continue to disagree on.
Crucially, they are free to disagree on it.
And are free to disagree on, absolutely. And lawyers are free to go to court and to try and argue one case or the other. And a government which is trying to effectively rewrite the past by removing part of that past which uncontestedly happened. Yeah, there is no question that the Tiananmen Square protests happened, that many hundreds of people were killed in Tiananmen Square by the Chinese People's Liberation Army operating on behalf of the Chinese government at the time. And the Chinese government of today doesn't want that discussed, to the extent that, you know, before we started this recording, I Googled Tiananmen Square massacre to fact check a couple of things. I couldn't do that if we were in China.
No.
The great firewall of China, as it's called, blocks Tiananmen Square Tiananmen Square massacre as a search term. So, you know, we're dealing with a debate about a contested past happening in the open with effectively censorship. And so, you know, and you might, for example, say, well, you know, it's about removing statues and also, you know, that's an ancillary argument. The basis here is that we're dealing with a, broadly speaking, open and democratic process, as opposed to a piece of censorship in the interest of a government which doesn't want to have anybody arguing with its version of history.
State-sanctioned censorship and or mandated censorship. And I suppose what's at the core here is whether or not, and this is where it does relate to the role of an archaeologist or a historian or a curator or an educator, is whether or not these policies and these alterations have an effect on our ability to do the stuff of history, and that is namely the ability to explain and explore how and why it is we are where we are today. And often this, in a slightly more nationalistic narrative, it's why we are who we are today. In a slightly broader narrative, it's got other elements to it. But if pieces are being taken away and actively erased, expunged from the record, then it means that history can't actually be honestly told. Now there's a third sort of nuance here, and that is when museums are used, because they are these live spaces where national and local and personal, interpersonal stories are told and reframed. There's the possibility for a museum to become a space where, would you call it sort of active discussion? Formal negotiation in terms of the context and the meaning of these sorts of spaces.
Yeah. Well, what appears to have happened here is that during the course of a demonstration by the by students involved in the UK Student Climate Network, which is an environmental lobby group, the curators from the Science Museum did what they do, and curators from many museums, the Museum of London does this as well. They try and update their collections all the time by collecting contemporary material which falls within their remit. And on this occasion, the curators asked some of the demonstrators, could we have your placards at the end of the demonstration? One in particular is a placard of the Earth as a melting ice cream cone with the slogan "Keep it cool."
Yeah.
And the student owners of those particular placards said, "Yes, you know, it's going into the Science Museum, the National Collection of the Sciences. That is a public good thing." Then what happened is that the placards were included in the new show called Our Future Planet, which is sponsored by the Shell Petrochemical Corporation, which is heavily criticised for its involvement in fossil fuels and its continued promotion of fossil fuels as opponents see it, particularly in the view of the climate emergency. And we discussed the UN report on climate change a few weeks ago. The students who created the original placards went to the Science Museum and said, "Wait a minute, we gave these to your collection. We didn't want them put into an exhibition which is sponsored by an organisation which we believe is deeply damaging." And we believe, and essentially, they seem to be saying that by having that material appearing in that exhibition, they appear to be condoning what they will call greenwash by Shell.
Well, the UK Student Climate Network were quoted as saying, "We question why the Science Museum felt it was appropriate to display placards from these protests in an exhibition sponsored by Shell, one of the corporations that the climate strikes were fighting against." So, yeah, that's exactly what's at the heart of that.
Absolutely. And this comes against the background of two things. One is that the director of the Science Museum, Sir Ian Blatchford, is reported to still be actively seeking funding from fossil fuel companies. Now, this is an area that has got other organisations into trouble. The British Museums have problems with sponsorship by fossil fuel companies. But more particularly, in terms of the Science Museum, 2 months ago in July, Channel 4 News reported that in coming up with its sponsorship deal with Shell, the Science Museum had signed what is sometimes termed a gagging clause, which, in quotes, prevented the Science Museum from, quotes, damaging the goodwill or reputation, end quote, of Shell. Now, I think any independent observer of these things, any journalist, any historian actually worth their salt, any archaeologist worth their salt, to actually sign up in advance not to criticise something is a form of censorship.
Yeah.
And is not acceptable, particularly in an academic, you know, an institution like a museum, which is meant to be a place to explore and learn.
And arguably, this is precisely why having adequate budgets is a good idea for museums. It means that they're not vulnerable to these sorts of requests from people who are essentially subsidising and filling in gaps when it comes to putting on exhibitions in museum spaces. I suppose one could be slightly cynical and say, well, that's precisely why budgets are kept small, so that museums, etc., might be more amenable to messaging and this kind of thing. But that's a very complex, nuanced conversation that's required there. But nonetheless, it does raise this question, and it raises a very important recurring, echoing point, I think, in our conversations in Watching Brief, as to the nature of what we do. And that is to say, it is, by its very nature, often a fairly difficult and politically laden topic. We're looking at the past of human beings, and politics is nothing other really than presenting people with a story that gets them excited so that they vote for you. And that story often revolves around ideas of our past, and therefore a vision of our future as well, often based upon ideas of our past. And so just to bring this section to a close, this brings us to something that's come out of the DW, the German news agency, where in their arts section they have a headline here, call to preserve Afghan cultural heritage and protect workers. Now I do believe that they're not the first to make this sort of call highlight this call rather, sorry, in the past few weeks. But it does highlight the necessary consideration of the importance of this sort of problem, in so much as there's been a tendency in the past few weeks I've seen on Twitter in particular, myself, for colleagues and friends even to dare I say pontificate about the need to, you know, not be too loud about our concerns about archaeological heritage and museums, etc. We need to think more mostly about the people involved in conflict, and this is true. But what we see when we look more closely is that museums, cultural heritage, because they are live issues, and for example, actually this morning there are unconfirmed reports from the Bamiyan Cultural Museum of artifacts being looted and or destroyed, computers being damaged as well and taken away. That is unconfirmed, though we will have to try and confirm that. It's clear that for example, the Taliban are not unaware of the power of this material, and also of the people who've been working with this material over the past couple of decades. So in this instance, employees of museums and archaeological sites also need protection, says the news story, in the wake of Taliban takeover of Afghanistan.
The biggest concern, obviously, is the people. And we said on Watching Brief before, you protect... We talked about it the other day, the other week when we were talking about Tigray. Mm. You know, you protect the past by protecting the people. Mm. And there is an issue, again, this ties in with our earlier discussion about Tiananmen and Confederate statues in the United States and so on, in that here we are dealing with a government that, when it was last in power, chose, for ideological and religious reasons, it would appear, to do two things. One was to turn a blind eye to looting and trafficking of art objects and artifacts and antiquities to the outside world, and particularly into Western art markets. But at the same time, as a cultural and political statement, it was destroying elements of Afghanistan's culture that didn't, in its view, tie into its worldview of what Afghanistan is and should be. The most famous instance is the blowing up of the Bamiyan Buddhas. Mm. Incredibly beautiful, significant examples of the influence of Buddhist culture in Afghanistan, mm. which were deliberately blown up, mm. And have been the subject of a lot of debate and attempts at restoration. And you talked about the Bamiyan Museum mm. earlier. Whether we'll see that again, I mean, the Develt article that you quoted, basically is an interview with a German archaeologist called Ute Franke, and she is asked a number of questions in the course of the article. And she was asked, do you believe the Taliban's assurances that they'll respect cultural treasures in the future? There's been a lot of talk of a Taliban 2.0, that this isn't the Taliban that took power in the 1990s. They're much more savvy, they're much more aware of their public image, and they want to and need to engage with the outside world because they need development money apart from anything else, and they need the Afghan government's assets unfrozen. Mm. Ute Franke says, I can't assess that at the moment. I hope it's true, but there's a certain skepticism based on past experiences, and they go beyond the destruction of the Buddha statues in the Bamiyan Valley. After all, one hears that there have already been attacks in Bamiyan, including on the depots. It would be nice if promises to protect archaeological sites and to prohibit robbery excavations would be kept. That will be seen in the near future. I think all we can do is two things here. One is to be aware, and for the border authorities to be aware, for our auction houses to be aware of the distinct possibility that the next months and years, we'll see an increase in unprovenanced Afghanistan antiquities and objects appearing in Western antiquities markets.
Mm. Well, actually, this week there was a story in Norway where a lot of artifacts that were, I think, looted from Iraq were recovered in by police there. Yes. So, yeah, it's a sad.
Hobby Lobby.
It's a sad echo. It's a sad ripple that follows on from these. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I suppose.
But I think that the other thing I'd say is perhaps more important even than the objects. There are people still in Afghanistan who worked for international bodies and with international workers. There are archaeological projects, museum projects, and so on. Many of those people now may well feel now in personal danger because of their involvement with the outside world, with a subject that historically the Taliban doesn't have any time for, and in fact actively opposes. Which, you know, the study of the cultural nuances and richness of the country that go way beyond its Islamic culture, you know, which is rich in itself, but. You know, the Buddhist influence, the Greek influence through the border of the Empire of Alexander, and then the Empire of Persia, and so on. You know, Afghanistan is this incredible historical cultural crossroads in Asia.
So, with all of these factors, working in such live historical and political environments, whether it's with regimes who don't want you to tell the full story, whether it's negotiating with the public as to how the story might be better told, whether it's working in contested or even conflict zones and trying to manage the human story that's still being written in many cases through those conflicts, it's little wonder that so many archaeologists, historians, and others are feeling the pressure at the moment. And this is before we come to a story that was published 3 days ago by based upon research by the UCU, University College Union, from work done at Newcastle University, where they surveyed 429 people between February and April in 2021. And came to the conclusion that university staff are facing an unmanageable workload, with women who are suffering, it seems, the most. The poll found 78% of staff overall had described their workload as unmanageable at least half of the time, and that people were working 20% longer than their expected hours. And it should be said that this isn't because of the pandemic, it's simply been made worse by the pandemic, hasn't it, Andy?
That's right. I think one of the striking things in the report, and I do urge again our viewers to look it up and to read it.
Well, it'll be linked below, so they'll have the link to this and the news story below. Yeah,
absolutely. It's actually quite a sobering account of what it's like, or the perception of what of the sample of what it's like to work in UK higher education. At the moment, as you say, it's not just referring to the impact of the pandemic. Obviously, that is key. It talks about, for example, the difficulty that people have had working from home in balancing their teaching duties with, for example, childcare and homeschooling.
Yep. And also having to enact so-called blended learning regimes as well. So having something that's at times face-to-face, at times digital.
That's right. And it talks to structural issues too, like, for example, the allegation that management has flip-flopped between wanting to go from an entirely online learning regime to the kind of blended regime that you've just referred to, and any variation in between, which has only added to the workload because people have had to, you know, constantly rejig, reconfigure what they're doing. And so it's not just the teaching time, it's the preparation time that we're talking about. I think people forget that perhaps sometimes when we're talking about higher education. It's not somebody delivering lectures that they've been delivering to the same module for year on year. It's having to rejig that module and then rejig the module again because of different social distancing rules being in place and so on. You know, so it's a very complex moving image of an area which is putting people under additional stress on top of the existing issues, like, for example, working more hours than you're contracted for because you've taken on additional admin roles, for example, or you're having to prepare a new module. The stresses of, for example, fixed term contracts or 0 hours contracts mean academics don't know that they're going to even be employment, you know, this time next month, let alone this time next year.
Make for a secure or healthy mind, as it were. On top of that as well, I mean, just in my experience in working with, this isn't Newcastle, but some other departments, we've been working on projects that have taken 9 months and they're still ongoing, when actually really the ideal would have been a 3-month turnaround on some of this stuff. But it's because we've been having to deal with, oh, suddenly these 30 people have COVID, or this person has to isolate, or that, you know, it has been definitely made worse by the pandemic.
Absolutely. I mean, there was a report that, and it's cited in the Newcastle report, there was a report that was done by the University of Durham, Durham University, which reported only just under half of the staff surveyed, that 47% of the people surveyed reported their mental health as being poor. 55% described themselves as being emotionally exhausted.
I'll put up my hand.
It's not. Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. And as you say, it's not just the responsibilities to universities and to students. The Newcastle report quotes somebody as saying, you know, I can't shake the feeling that in trying to keep up with all the work demands, I've let down my child. And if I try to accept that the just do what you can approach, my own stress and anxiety rockets to nearly paralyzing levels, which I have to push through. Yeah. Most days, I feel I'm just barely clinging on with my fingernails on the cliff face. I'm pretty stoic and able to cope with tough times, lots of practice, but I cry most days now. And I think, yeah, okay, there will be people out there, not necessarily our viewers, but there will be people out there who say, you know, snowflakes, just suck it up. The bus driver and the supermarket worker who's been, you know, has had it, you know, just as tough, if not tougher. But I think, first of all, everybody deserves to be treated well. Nobody should be made to feel like that just by going to work. And I think whatever happens in other sectors, one thing that's been driven home to me in the last few months covering the stories at Sheffield and at Worcester and at Chester is how actually university managements have taken actions which have laid stress, additional stress and distress on their staff and on their students, actually. Because I think we mustn't forget students in this too, and this is a report about the teaching staff. But university managements have taken decisions which have laid these additional stresses on people at a time which is already, unprecedentedly stressful. You know, the world we're living in now is one that is disconcerting, discombobulating, sometimes even frightening, perhaps. And they've taken these actions in way cause stress, which is entirely avoidable. In both the case at Sheffield and particularly at Worcester, which I've been looking at most recently, the university appears to have made no preparation for supplying support, direct support to the people most affected by the decision to close courses, which is, considering they have a legal responsibility under the Health and Safety at Work Act to support their staff, including in areas of mental health. I just find it deeply sad that people can that people can have so little consideration for those responsibilities.
Well, and it Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the findings here, the executive summary, one of the summary points is that people working much longer than expected in terms of their hours per week, and that working those longer hours up to 20 to 30% more than contracted has become the norm, not the exception.
Yeah.
And this brings us on to, I suppose, a broader point, and that is that part of the response to this report in the past few days has been to see people saying, at the very least, that they recognize this. They go, yep, that's happening at my university. I feel like that. Mm. That's the way it certainly is, you know, wherever I work. And at a slightly more extreme in terms of the response, we've actually seen people saying, and that's normal. That's just life. That's just, you know, what do you expect if you want to be an academic? And I suppose it reminded me, unfortunately, of some of the less helpful responses to, for example, the hashtag MeToo movement on that we saw initially exploding on Twitter, where some people, particularly often established figures, figures who felt that they had been through various systems, more or less said, what are you complaining about? That is the way it is. That's the way I had to do that, you know, and look at me now. It didn't do me any harm. And you know, we can't speak for those people as to whether or not they're in some form of denial, but certainly they shouldn't be wishing a harmful work environment on other people just because it has become normal. It's problematic in that sense.
Yeah, look, that kind of culture, that, you know, it was like that for me when I was your age. This is how I got to be, you know, where I am now. You know, you want to be here, you have to be there.
Yeah.
And that is a kind of culture that in areas like, for example, medicine, in the treatment of junior doctors, they've been trying to get rid of that culture for the last couple of decades. They realize how damaging it actually is.
Yeah.
So if people in the heritage sector, in higher education, in heritage and archaeology are coming across that kind of attitude, then boy, we've got a lot to learn, because that's been recognized as damaging in other sectors for a long time.
Mm.
It's not easy to remedy.
No.
But at least the recognition's there that it's not the way that it doesn't create a healthy workforce. Literally, it doesn't create a healthy workforce. It certainly doesn't create a healthy relationship between different parts of that workforce.
Mm, mm.
You know, so I think it's one of those areas where the pandemic has highlighted particular issues, particular problems, and the ramifications are going to take a long while to work through and work out.
And hopefully they will work out, and hopefully we'll be around to see them work out. In so much as this is also coming in the context of as you've alluded to it, Sheffield and Worcester unhelpful management practices. That once again, I would trail our Muppet of the Month. We're going to be recording early next week. Where, you know, managers could be more helpful when it comes to reassuring their staff as to, frankly, even what they think of the work that they do. But anyway, I don't want to go too much into that. It is genuinely a high-end Muppetry, though, that we'll be highlighting.
It's a classic.
And something else that I'd like to highlight right at the end of this week's Watching Brief is our Patreon page. ArchaeoSoup has a Patreon account where we've instigated a tier recently specifically for you guys to support our work on Watching Brief. This weekly format, especially with the more investigative elements and interviewing people and preparing the proper questions and editing, has become, I suppose, not more intensive, but certainly we've become more aware of how regularly we work on this stuff. And in that context of mental health and valuing work, I suppose what I would invite you to do is just maybe consider supporting us on Patreon. You'd be very welcome in terms of that support. And the tier is called the Leek and Potato Soup tier. I don't know who's leek and who's potato. I'm happy to be potato.
I'll happily receive the leeks.
Okay, Grant, you can be leek. I'll be potato. and also there's a bread bun on the side. We can both dive in and stay nice and warm. Anyway, regardless, do check out Patreon if you're interested. Your support would be very welcome. And we are actually considering changes to what we might offer in terms of Patreon for Watching Brief. But initially, we just wanted to highlight this because the past few weeks haven't really felt like the time to talk about Patreon, have they, Andy? We haven't wanted to say at the end of, for example, when we're interviewing people at Worcester University, oh, by the way, we have a Patreon. It just didn't feel appropriate. But I think in the context of being, you know, tired and strung out and in a stressful and difficult work environment sometimes, your support would be very welcome, folks. Please do consider it. I suppose that's it for this week's Watching Brief, Andy. Like I say, look forward to next week's Muppet of the Month, and who knows where we will be. There are a couple of stories brewing on the horizon, but we can't really even hint at them, can we, at the moment? There's stuff on the whiteboard that's behind you that we can't show either, so exciting news is a coming, I suppose. Did you have any sort of, you know, nose tapping hints at all?
No.
Excellent, grand. Well, thank you for your time this morning, Andy. Thank you guys for watching and listening at home, and until next time, do take care. Bye bye.
This podcast episode has been produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network in collaboration with ArchaeoSoup Productions. Find out more podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.